Welcome to the HR Power Hour, presented by Career Management Associates. I'm David Chulo. It's about all things in the human resource world. We're going to bring in local, regional, and national guests, and we're going to talk about a variety of topics and explain why human resource management is critical to your business success so that you can make decisions to keep and retain great talent. Welcome to the fifth anniversary show for the HR Power Hour. It doesn't seem possible that 5 years ago I sat behind this microphone talking to you, the audience, a much smaller audience at that time, about HR education and about providing you some of the best people out there to talk about what matters to you. I want to thank you, the audience, for each and every week coming to the site, clicking on your favorite show, and providing the HR education to yourselves, because that is a big deal. You are providing education to yourselves, and I want to thank you so much for being there. I've enjoyed it. I continue to enjoy it, and I'm looking forward to another great year. One of the reasons that we're able to do this is because of our sponsors. Jackson Lewis Law Firm, all we do is work. A great sponsor. They've provided great content on our show, and we want to thank them so much for it. Redmond Winchell, another great sponsor. Law firm up in Bangor, Maine, again, providing great information. And you're going to hear today one of the segments talk about some of the information that was provided by Anne Marie. We also have Sheehan Finney, a fantastic law firm in New Hampshire that provides great counsel to employers. It's very important in the New Hampshire market. They have a great attorney firm, and they're one of the best. And, of course, Verrill Dana, another solid law firm that covers the Northeast, a great law firm, attorneys at law, and they have done a great job this year providing us the tips of the week. They've been doing the Tips of the Week segment. Please make sure you go to the website, hrpowerhour.com. Go to the Tip of the Week section, and it will be provided you a tip that you can share with your team. Also, Strategic HR, they provide three major conferences across the year, one being the main HR convention, the second being the Strategic HR convention, and the third, of course, is the Comp Summit, another great partner from the beginning. We are proud to have them on our team. I also want to tell you that this year we provided content from across the country. Many different places have provided us information, and I want to truly thank our teachers, or in our case, our guests that have come on to really talk about these incredible topics that have provided you information across the platform. So our show today is going to be providing you some fun. I know Debbie Davis, our producer, who I appreciate more than you can all know, making sure that I sound good to you and our guests sound amazing, is obviously going to be providing you some fun takeouts. That's right. Bloopers that I have done over the year. I know it's hard to believe that I would make mistakes, but yes, they do happen when we tape, and Debbie is so kind to bring them up during our anniversary show, so please enjoy them. It's part of the fun. What we're going to be doing today on our fifth anniversary show is providing you some highlights from eight shows across the last year, topics that were important to you, and you stated in comments and content to me that these are some of the ones that made a difference to you. And so we're going to be talking about things like legal updates. We're going to be talking things like things that may have helped you understand better about employment law. We're going to be talking about things that are going to improve you as an individual, employee engagement, immigration, all sorts of topics that have made a huge difference here on the HR Power Hour. We got another year coming up, and we've got some great guests we've already lined up, and we're going to be looking for some international flair a little later this year to try to get us some international guests as well. So I'm looking forward to it. So let's kick it off. We're back in July. We had Joy Rothschild. She is the Chief Human Resource Officer for Omni Hotels. She talked about open checkbook for ROI, and here's a segment of her show. You know, I think one of the questions that people always ask themselves is, How do you really sometimes know what the definition of success is? A lot of people say, hey, I know it when I see it. But how do you strategize for that path?
So I already said earlier, our trilogy is we want to satisfy customers, satisfy associates, satisfy the owner. That's our definition of success. So if we're missing a leg of the trilogy, if we have a property or a department where we're not satisfying the customer, what's the goal? The goal is customer satisfaction. What's stopping us from reaching the goal? And you start to dig down whether you're asking the associates what's stopping the problem or if you can see what's stopping you from reaching the goal. That's where we start. And when you have a common definition of success as a company, I think it's easier to identify those opportunities where you might be missing it. And then you need to come up with what changes have to happen. How do we know they're going to solve the problem? Well, the way you figure that out is you test it. But I think you have to start from a foundation of this is the end game.
You know, HR professionals, as they're looking and say, okay, this is the end game, we face so many challenges to get to that point, right? How do they take the simple steps to move forward? And is it as simple as setting a timeline and working through that? How do you get the engagement on point to get people and understand change? Because change is hard.
Change is very hard. I think you have to articulate how the source of pain or opportunity impacts your organization. So there's really two different ways to look at it. One is this issue is causing us organizational pain, or we missed the boat in addressing this issue, and now we have to hurry up and catch up. And the easiest way to agree on something, to me, is to use data to quantify how the problem negatively impacts business results, and then use data to figure out how to solve the problem. And when you're using data, it forces you to come up with more than one solution for a problem. And I have a real life example if you want me to.
No, that'd be great. Please, yes. Real life would be great. Yes.
Okay. So we had a hotel in Nashville, and we had less than satisfactory customer satisfaction ratings on the housekeeping part of the stay. So we asked guests, was your room clean? Was everything in working order, et cetera? And we were not having very good scores in Nashville. And so we then look at, well, why aren't the rooms as clean as they could be? And we realize that we have a lot of contract labor cleaning the rooms. And then you say, well, why is contract labor cleaning the rooms instead of employees? Well, I can't hire employees because our starting rate is too low. Okay, so then you have your goal, which is address the staffing challenges in housekeeping, which is affecting customer satisfaction. So we went back to the very beginning, which I think is a really good exercise to do, and we said, okay, let's look at the data. What was the starting rate when we opened the hotel? We opened the hotel with a starting rate that was based on what the starting rate was in Dallas, Texas. So somebody looked at the budget for Dallas, Texas, and said, oh, that's what they pay housekeepers in Dallas. That's what we'll pay them in Nashville. So we then looked at what are we spending on temp labor. Well, we were spending hundreds of thousands of dollars on temp labor. Then we looked at how many overtime hours did we have. We had 17,000 overtime hours. So clearly, when you look at the actual numbers, we opened with a starting wage of $8.50 for room attendants. We moved it up to 9. That didn't help. You look at what you're paying temp labor, $12.50 an hour. And then when you factor in the overtime, we're spending $13.50 an hour on our labor force with overtime. So what we came up with was, we said, we're looking for people that are experienced. We are willing to pay for that experience. So if you show up at the Omni with over 5 years of housekeeping experience anywhere else, we're going to pay you $12 an hour. If you show up with 3 to 5 years of experience, we're going to pay you $11 an hour. And if you show up with less than 3 years of experience, we're going to pay you $10 an hour. At the time that we changed the model, we had 22 openings. 10 days later, we had filled 18 of them. And today I can tell you, we only have 2 open positions. This has worked. We came into a market at the wrong wage rate. It caused organizational pain. We looked at many different ways to solve it. We think we came up with the right model, and it's worked, and it's sustained over time, and this is going to be the model that we use in another market.
I think what you're really talking about is how, in fact, a lot of the times companies don't necessarily think about really looking at the data. They just have a quick decision, right? They just make a quick decision. We're going to throw another 50 cents at it, another buck at it, but not really taking the time to go back and really model it out, right? And taking that time, because that does take time. But it always is. If you plan it out, if you strategically think it out, you'll always come up with a better solution than just throwing money at a situation.
Blooper.
The author of The Power of Productive.
There's no D in that word, Dave.
Okay. Joy, that was great. We appreciate the information you've provided to us. Next show that we're going to provide you a little snippet from was a 2-part series that we did on immigration for employment. Nathan Waricki, business immigration attorney for Sheehan Finney Bass & Green, came on and talked to us about the real challenges to immigration for employment. He provided 2 full hours of content, information for you. And of course, remember, you can always go back in our archives at hrpowerhour.com. Look for the month, which I'm telling you is obviously in September, or type in his name, Waricki, W-A-R-E-C-K-I, in the search engine in the upper right-hand column, and you'll be brought to the show so that you can listen to the 2 parts of immigration employment. Take it away, Nathan. So you're talking about bringing somebody into the United States in regards to working. Are there specific countries? Let's start with the base here. Are there specific countries in that it is more of a challenge, and are there differences from country to country, or is there a standard process that is across, you know, from bringing somebody in from almost any country?
Yeah. So the way that the immigration law works is there is a worldwide quota on immigrant visas, and just to back up a second. There's a big difference in immigration law between an immigrant visa and a non-immigrant visa. An immigrant visa is a permanent residence, and so that is a green card that everyone is probably familiar with. And a non-immigrant visa is a temporary visa, which is good for a number of years, but does ultimately expire and need renewal, or in some cases it can't be renewed any longer. So what we see is that because there's a worldwide quota on the immigrant visas, there's not a lot of challenges that are applicable to a certain nationality. The only exception with that is that in the immigrant realm, the immigration law has a per country limitation, meaning that countries who have historically had the lion's share of immigrants to the United States, there's a per country limitation piece of the law which says that we're not going to. So, for instance, India and China are 2 of the countries that historically have been the country of origin for many immigrants. The law now says that immigration from those countries is limited each year so that we have some more diversity in the number of the nationality of immigrants coming to the United States. So that's the main difference in terms of nationalities.
So it's not based upon skill set. It's based upon, in that particular case, the number of workers allowed into the United States from each country specifically.
That's part of the metric. The other part of the metric is, as you just said, the skills and the need of the employers. So again, going into the immigrant realm, the way that the visas are allotted, green cards are allotted, is based on a priority system. That priority system, which is 5 different priority preferences categories, they call them, starts with the first preference category, which is for your Oppenheimers and Einsteins and those types of folks who have extraordinary abilities, and also for outstanding researchers, and then for multinational executives. The second preference category is for your exceptional workers. So there's a difference between extraordinary and exceptional. And also in the second preference category, professionals with advanced degrees, meaning professionals with master's degrees. And in the third category, you have your skilled workers and also your unskilled workers. So that's folks who either have a bachelor's degree, skilled workers, or 2 years of experience, or unskilled workers who have less than 2 years. So that's one part of the metric matrix that's used, and the other part is the nationality, which creates some special challenges for companies who are looking for employees from India or China.
Bloober.
President of HR at Maine Savings Federal Community. You know, the mouth and the tongue did not work. Wrong, 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 wrong. That was great information on immigration law. And obviously, it's important for you to understand that this is something you should not do alone. There are a lot of nuances to this, and that's why you should have somebody to guide you through. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM on the 5th Anniversary Show. And we'll be right back.
At 154 years old, Beryl Dana has an illustrious history and more than seven generations of legal expertise. With more than 130 attorneys across seven offices from Maine to Washington, D.C., Beryl Dana serves clients across the country and around the world. HR professionals, business leaders, and in-house counsel count on Beryl Dana, one of the premier labor and employment law practices in the Northeast. Contact them today at BerylDana.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM and presented by CMAcareer.com and Maine.DaleCarnegie.com. We're talking about our 5th anniversary show. We're going back through some of the great content that we've had in 2016/17. We're going to be talking about some of the stuff that were big hits to you and you told us made a difference in your ability as HR professional business leaders to move along in your organization and make a difference. Our next show we're going to highlight was on November 5th, 2016. It's called Navigating the Big Shift. Nancy Giordano, founder and CEO of Big Play Inc., was our guest. She's a strategic futurist, and she talked about navigating the big shift. Here's a segment of her great show. And, you know, we're talking today about, you know, some great stuff. She was up at the New Hampshire Strategic HR Convention. We're talking about the big shift, why leaders must know about the new economy. That was your talk, Nancy. I mean, tell me a little bit about the subject and what got you excited about it.
Well, my company is Play Big for a reason, right? It's really this idea that if you bring all of our resources and our equities and our knowledge forward, we have the opportunity to solve some really big problems and or create really huge and meaningful opportunities. It's about really thinking about the need right now of business leaders is not to show up in a transactional way, but in a way that really builds trust and, again, drives innovation. So we have this perspective that drives our thinking strategically, which is around we're moving from a culture of extraction to a culture of investment. So companies and organizations that think about, again, all the ways in which they can invest in their stakeholders, which are their employees, their partners, society, thinking about all the ways in which they touch an ecosystem in order to also still create a product and a service that people want to buy. You know, it's not anti-profit. It's very pro-profit. But we believe that in the future, partly because of this giant technical wave that we are our technological wave that we're barely at the front of. Trust will be a really, really important currency, and we need to think about ways that we develop that. So stepping back, you know, I just completed a conference that I produced that was all about the seven most disruptive technologies and how they will change business. And so I can really get a good feature not just on the cultural changes that are happening, the demographic changes and the economic changes, which is sort of the first wave of the big shift. So we've got this other big wave. It's called AI and robotics and 3D printing and nanotechnology and VR, AR, right, and shifting cybersecurity and how we will interface with our machines. So, you know, it's kind of a phenomenally interesting world to be walking through, and again, to learn different ways in which we show up as leaders and that we show up as creators in that space.
Blooper.
And she's the author of the book, From My Bad to My Best, How Individuals and Companies Can Differentiate Themselves in an Age of Meteorocracy. Damn it. In the Age of Meteorocracy. Is that better? I have no idea what I'm saying. Cannot say this word. Can't say it. Can't say it. Damn, I can't say it. Me. D. Ah. Cra. Ah. 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 Cra. T. Mediocrity. Okay. From My Bad to My Best, How Individuals and Companies Can Differentiate Themselves in the Age of Meteorocrity. No, and I'm looking at... She's dying on me. Cannot say this word.
Mediocrity.
From My Bad to My Best, How Individuals and Companies Can Differentiate Themselves in the Age of Mediocrity. I'm not saying it again. Cut and paste, cut and paste, cut and paste. Thank you, Nancy, for providing us some really great things to think about. And I know HR professionals are going to be looking at these for the upcoming year. In January 2017, we had a new president. And Deborah Weiss Ford, litigation manager and shareholder at Jackson Lewis Law Firm, talked to us about workplace law under a Trump presidency. A big deal in 2017. Here's what she sees is going to happen this year in 2017.
Under Obama, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission has been extremely aggressive in enforcement efforts, and it has intentionally pursued certain targeted areas, such as criminal background checks, LGBT protections, systemic discrimination. All of those have been target opportunities for the EEOC to say to employers, look, you need to look at these programs carefully and decide whether or not they are discriminatory. So, for example, when we talk about systemic discrimination, that really means a pattern or practice where discrimination has a broad impact in the industry, so that a company could engage in, for example, discrimination barriers in hiring, in recruiting. When a company does a reduction in force, you could be looking at age issues, and the EEOC has been extremely aggressive under President Obama in making sure that employers are more in tune with discriminatory issues. And that, we expect under President Trump, will likely change. I think we're all expecting that we are going to see a very different outlook on the EEOC.
Am I not correct in remembering that didn't the EEOC even go after a company without any complaints?
It did. It did. It's been extremely aggressive. It has been looking for various issues to take up. For example, the transgender issue. The EEOC has been very aggressive in looking into those discriminatory areas, and actually, without even a complaint, has been going out and looking for various issues that it can take up to try to make some widespread changes.
Okay, so we'll assume that they're going to curtail their efforts a little bit. Also, I believe that President Trump will be able to appoint new commissioners, correct?
He'll be able to appoint new commissioners. We certainly will see that. And what we're expecting is that these commissioners will probably change what's known as the Strategic Enforcement Plan. So what that means is that the EEOC will issue periodically strategic enforcement plans for various fiscal years. And under Obama, the plan was revised fairly recently for fiscal years 2017 and 2021. And really, the federal agency was looking at six different broad enforcement priorities that was laid out in the plan. And we expect that those six different areas will probably not be too much of interest to President Trump. So likely that that strategic plan is going to change and probably fairly rapidly.
Blooper.
Last week, hopefully you listen. Hopefully you listen.
Blooper.
Hopefully. Wow. Very proud of me. So let's welcome. Welcome. What the heck am I doing? I need water. Let's welcome Nancy. Thank you for that great information, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour's fifth anniversary show on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM, and we will be right back.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis, as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at JacksonLewis.com. That's JacksonLewis.com.
The HR Power Hour that you're listening to is 5 years old, and I'm your host, David Chulo. And we're talking about our fifth anniversary show today and some of the key areas and key shows that have really made a difference in 2016 and now into 2017. So let's look at our next one in January 2017. Of course, it was time for some legal information and updates. So our good friend, Jim Reedy, who's the employment attorney and chairman of the Labor and Employment Law Group at Sheehan Finney, came on to talk about how not to create problems you're trying to avoid. HR professionals understand that. Business leaders understand that. So let's listen to Jim tell us some great tips.
This area of the law has evolved. And it's not just the traditional sex harassment of touching or invitation and so on. It's in some ways more subtle. It also, like I said earlier, it has expanded into other areas of discrimination. And also, it's not just the underlying sex harassment, but if someone complains about something or somebody else participates in an investigation, that person may be protected under the retaliation parts of federal and state discrimination laws, which are in many ways more potent. Said another way, the underlying discrimination claim may be dismissed as being, well, it really didn't meet the standard of what the law requires. However, because the person complained, because the person participated in an investigation, they do have an active retaliation claim. So what does that mean? It's the shock and awe of employment law, and that rhyme was unintentional, but I'll still use it. the shock and awe of employment law, which is when it becomes personal, when something I've done or haven't paid attention to results in a claim against my employer, and I'm talking about an HR professional now, and it is I'm tied up with lawyers. I am the company is now taking its attention away from research and development and focusing instead on defending against a claim. This is dragging down our market share. There's adverse publicity, and perhaps of equal importance, in addition to the cost to the organization of potential exposure, or even then, just simply defending the claim, there's the potential for individual liability. And where does that typically come up? Well, on the retaliation end with regard to federal law. However, there are states like New Hampshire where this year said, you, CEO, may be personally liable for the underlying harassment, because until that decision came out in a case this last year before our Supreme Court, it was no individual liability, it's corporate liability, it's the entity that's liable. But now we're starting to see a trend, and even little New Hampshire has a case that says the individual may be liable for the harassment in addition to potentially for retaliation. So that gets their attention, because I often say in training, how many of you have a couple million dollars squirreled away in a rainy day fund?
Oh, I'm sure everyone does, Jim. Come on, everybody.
And most homeowners and umbrella policies don't cover intentional acts or acts of this nature.
Well, I think
so
that's
it's an uninsured claim,
right? I think that's the key right there, right? Somebody might say, well, you know, I might be covered under insurance policy. The reality is, you probably are not.
Right.
You're not covered. Even if you may have some, you know, updated policies, you may have something that protects your organization, and most people don't cover a personal errors and omissions liability policy for themselves. That's just not something.
And here's the other thing that causes HR people to lose sleep at night. One, because their job may be in jeopardy if the matter is mishandled, and because it was their job to train the supervisors and keep an eye on it. Here's the other. Whereas traditional sex harassment and other forms of harassment were something you could see, at more than a third of claims in the last year have been electronic, meaning it's no longer reach out and touch somebody. It is email, texting, sexting, social media, and the like. So the question is, how do HR professionals know about this when it's sort of insidious going through electronic transmission?
Blooper.
And today on the HR Power Hour, we're going to be geeking with... I
Blooper.
Get a little chulo in me, I'm sorry. A little chuloism, sorry. Sorry.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM and presented by CMAcareer.com and Maine.DaleCarnegie.com. We're talking about our fifth anniversary show today, and we're talking about semi-absentee business ownership as one of the hot topics that happened in 2017, exactly on March 11th, 2017, to be exact, when Chris Sinkar with FranChoice talked about a business opportunity called semi-absentee business ownership. Was it something you considered after you listened to his topic? I know it's something that I considered.
Really?
Well, you know, I got to tell you, as you know, semi-absentee business ownership from the show, Chris Sinkar, franchise consultant with FranChoice, talked about it. It sounded so simple. It isn't. But let's listen to Chris and let him explain what it really means.
So I think one of the interesting parts, David, is that I have found there's a couple of major advantages to franchising over independent business ownership. And just as you have in your career done both, I've done both as well. I think one of the biggest points on the startup cycle is that owning a franchise really tends to put you on the fast track. Because, as you said, all of those processes and procedures are already in place, it allows you to fast-track your marketing. It allows you to pick up customers faster. It allows you to build your business to a profitable point in a matter of months instead of years. And it makes it a lot easier. And then, one of the other points, David, that you'll know from your experience with Dale Carnegie, it allows you an opportunity to be able to network with other individual owners who are in exactly the same business position as you. It allows you to have peer learning immediately. And it allows you to be able to, instead of being a lonely business owner, where you feel like you're the only one struggling with that challenge, you realize that there's other people in your franchise who not only have faced that challenge, but because they might have already been in the system for longer than you, they've faced it. And they've already tackled it and won that challenge.
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, it really does. I mean, that's probably the biggest win, right? I mean, because it's not only the processes are in place, but people will be willing to help you and move you along in the process.
No doubt about it.
So, we're talking a little bit about here about two things. One, somebody who might be out there who's currently working, who thinks about a transition from employment into business ownership, right? And they're saying, how much time does it take to think about this in terms of actually looking into it, go through the process? We're going to talk about one particular type of a franchise model here, but I really want to give people a kind of a feel from somebody who starts thinking about it to researching to go through it. What's the timeline kind of look like?
So I'll give you an example, David. I'm working, in my franchise consulting practice where I work with individuals who are looking to make this transition into franchise ownership. Most of the folks that I work with, David, that cycle typically takes them between 3 and 4 months. From the time that we really start having a conversation about franchising and I really start asking them detailed questions about what types of opportunities are interesting to them and what they want to do every day and what they don't want to do every day. From when we start that conversation until they're in a position where they have joined a franchise system and they're starting to get trained and ready to operate that business. That's normally 3 to 4 months. So as we sit here in the springtime, it's completely realistic for your listeners that by the time that summer vacation's over and their kids go back to school, they could be business owners.
And that truly is, actually, when you think about it, a short period of time.
Absolutely. I mean, if you think, David, I mean, we're going to spend in our careers 40 years in the workforce, building a career. And what I would like to say to people is, I'd rather you not only build a career, but I'd rather you build an asset while you're building a career. You can find opportunities in your career where you go out, you have a job that you love, and you're paid every day to do that job. But when you're done, they're not going to pay you anymore. There's no terminal value to that. But if you own a business, you're not only going to go out every day and enjoy building a career and earn a living, but at the end of the day, you've also built an asset that you can then sell at the end and have that money to retire on. So I think you get a double benefit from it over your career.
And there really is an advantage to having a known name brand. I mean, I think that's something that is also sometimes underrated.
Well, certainly. I mean, you know, David, there's tons of examples of people who go out and build their own businesses from scratch. And that's a very successful model. But I think that jumping in and joining a franchise system where there's an established brand, where there's systems in place, where there's peer owners, what it allows you to do is not just speed through the process, but it reduces the risk of starting that business. Because that business has already been implemented and duplicated multiple times before. It's been refined. And when you're joining the system now, you're really jumping into a pretty known commodity that if you're joining a well-established system, the customers that you're going to be servicing might have already heard of the brand. They might already know the name before you even open your doors.
Bloober.
I'm sorry. And of the CHROs, why your roadmap to move from... Wow, did I mess that up,
Do
Debbie.
Do that again. We'll
Debbie.
Be right back with...
Blah, I need water. Please stand by. My mouth is dry. That was great information, Chris, and I appreciate you providing opportunities for our listeners who may be thinking about this great topic. You're listening to the HR Power Hour 5th Anniversary Show on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM, and we will be right back.
At 154 years old, Verrill Dana has an illustrious history and more than 7 generations of legal expertise. With more than 130 attorneys across 7 offices from Maine to Washington, D.C., Verrill Dana serves clients across the country and around the world. HR professionals, business leaders, and in-house counsel count on Verrill Dana, one of the premier labor and employment law practices in the Northeast. Contact them today at verrilldana.com.
If you're responsible for hiring and firing, you know it can be like a roulette wheel. If your new hire turns out to be a bad hire, well, all you've lost is time and money. Hello, I'm David Chulo of Career Management Associates. Don't gamble with your hiring. We have a better solution. We've helped hundreds of companies like yours find the right talent, and we guarantee it. Career Management Associates delivers people that fit. Go to cmacareer.com.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at jacksonlewis.com. That's jacksonlewis.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM and presented by cmacareer.com and maine.dalecarnegie.com. We're talking about our 5th anniversary show today, and we're looking at highlights of some of the great content provided over the last year of HR Power Hour Radio. And again, I want to thank all you, the listeners, once again for your constant listening to our show. We have over 17,000 people that get our newsletters every week, and we know that you're listening and tuning into this great show, so I appreciate it more than you possibly imagine, and we're going to continue to grow in 2017 into 2018. So let's talk about two great shows that happened in May. First was Anne Marie Story from Rudman & Winchell Law Firm, and they talked about an update to the FMLA. That's such an important thing, especially getting an update every year. We'll be bringing Embry back this year to continue with legal updates that really matter to you. Here's what she said on May 6, 2017.
Well, there was an interesting development, and this was not a case in Maine, but I think it would apply here, of course, since it's on the federal level, about the certification where an employee was out for a mental health issue, and the certification that they filled out, though, was from their own PCP, but the PCP said that the person was out, needed to be out, because she was under the care of a psychiatrist and a therapist. And so given the referral in the certification that was filled out to different specialists, the employer actually required the employee to submit a new certification from the treating psychiatrist, since that was the basis of the reason for the leave. And the court actually said that that was okay, and that if a person is treating with a specialist, then the employer is entitled to an opinion from that specialist as to the need for the leave. So I think that's a fairly significant development, only because it just clarifies, because I think a lot of times employers are very hesitant to question medical certifications because they don't want more information than they should have, and they don't want to second guess doctors because then you can get in trouble for doing that. So I think this gives a good basis for an employer who wants to do that. And then the same was true when she produced a fitness for duty certification, which the employer required. Again, she produced something from her PCP saying that she was medically cleared to go back to work. They, again, clarified that they wanted something from the psychiatrist, who's the one who said she needed to be out, and the court, again, said that was okay. But then they actually went a step further, because all the psychiatrist then said was that the individual was cleared medically to return to work. But there was no indication in the fitness for duty certification that psychiatrist knew what the employee's job duties were. And so the employer, again, went another step and said, well, that's great, except that now we need you to review this job description with the essential functions written out and then provide a certification that, in fact, this person is capable of doing these tasks. And again, the court said that that was okay and that it's reasonable for whoever is producing the fitness for duty certification to actually know what the basis is and what the employee's actual job is, so that they can provide that certification. And I think that's very significant as well, because a lot of times we see these, you know, a handwritten note saying okay to go back to work, and you do question, does this doctor have any idea what this person actually does for work? And we don't know how the employee has represented the job to them, and that's particularly true in a mental health situation.
Blooper.
Studio, talking with the one, the only, the great, the powerful, ever-knowing, all-seeing employment attorney, Tawny Alvarez.
Dun, 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 dun. I feel like the curtain should move away.
I should have had some applause up here.
Yeah, you can. We can put that in. That's the beauty of it.
Thanks, Anne-Marie. Also in May, we had another great guest, Tawny Alvarez, talked about affinity groups and when to call an attorney. She's an associate attorney with Verrill Dana, another great law firm, and she really provided you the key to the best time to call for an attorney.
Affinity groups are something that we're seeing more and more in the workplace, where we have groups of individuals who identify with each other based off of a certain element of their lives, whether or not that is based off of religion, sports, gender, working, if they're parenting and working, if they are of a different race or ethnicity. those would be the types of affinity groups that we see, not always in the workplace, but always kind of in life. So oftentimes we'll see affinity groups that naturally are created, right? People like each other. They have the same sense of humor. They eat lunch together. That, in a very loose term, would be an affinity group in the workplace. But what we're seeing more and more of is company-sponsored affinity groups. And the companies are using these affinity groups as a way to recruit, retain, and add to their company culture.
You know, as we think about these affinity groups, I think there's always been affinity groups, right? Sometimes people perceive those as those people become a clique in the organization. They can create sometimes a little niche of their own, and people sometimes say, hey, whether it's in an organization, whether it's in an association, whether it's in another group, that these little cliques form. And that can create issues within the workplace.
It most definitely can create issues. And it can create issues organically, just because certain people are hanging out with each other, spending time during the work day or outside of the work day together. And then simultaneously, if it is a company sponsored affinity groups, it simultaneously can create risk for the organization. So while there are great benefits to having affinity groups, it promotes diversity, creates more cultural awareness, could increase employee job satisfaction because you have groups of individuals who are talking about what they'd like to see their work environment look like, or changes to the organization, it simultaneously comes with risk. And you know me, I always love talking about risk.
Yes, you do. You know, so a company creates a group. So let's separate this. So affinity groups from a, if you want to say, personal side, personal groups that get together, you could say Facebook groups that get together, or, you know, like we said, cliques within an organization that, like, all the mothers get together to talk about their kids, all the fathers get together to talk about sports, or all those type of groups. So a company puts it together for a project or for, you know, tell me a little bit about why a company would create an affinity group to start with. You gave me all the reasons, but I mean, really, why? What's the genesis of doing it?
The genesis of doing it would be in order to find out how this group of individuals feels about their work environment and if there are things that the company itself could be doing to better attract and retain this segment of the population. It also could be that some of these affinity groups are created organically, in which the company doesn't initially have a goal with its creation, but that ultimately something is created. Now, I say there's these organic groups and then there's ones that are company created. I think at a foundational level, the best thing to guard against risk for any company to do is as soon as they realize either the need for an affinity group or that one naturally is created that they could derive benefits from, that they create a policy. So they have a policy that references affinity groups and how the company is going to handle affinity groups in a multitude of different ways.
So you're talking about a policy that, because as I think this through for a minute, so in some ways I could see this being for team building, right? To certainly create interdepartmental groups or cross-functional departmental groups, across team groups. I can see many reasons for doing this. So when you talk about a policy, how is that different than a communication policy, or is it part, or is it a subsection of it?
So let's do a scenario. You know,
sure.
How much
love
I love
scenarios. Perfect.
So let's say you have an LGBT affinity group, right? And the goal is to attract and retain more individuals who are active members of the LGBT community. And that is what the purpose of this group is. You don't have to identify as LGBT to be a part of it, right? That's going to be that's going to be first thing that you're going to include in your policy, right? So if you have an affinity group that's based off of this certain group, you're going to want to make sure that you are not discriminating against anyone in their membership based off of a protected class. So if you had a sports affinity group, you're not going to say, okay, only white men can be a part of the sports affinity group. If there are women who want to be a part of it, young women, old women, no matter what, we're not putting parameters around who can be a part of this affinity group. So let's say you've created an affinity group and Mary has been a part of the affinity group and she's taken this leadership role in the affinity group, right? So she's putting more and more time towards what this group's going to do, whether it's activities outside of the office, educational opportunities inside the office. But Mary's performance is really decreasing. She's not doing great in the office, right? So if you tell Mary she can no longer be a part of that affinity group, what type of retaliatory motive does that have? Is it because she was actively pushing an agenda, which was the purpose of that affinity group? Or was it because she wasn't performing up to par during her performance review? If you don't have a policy in place that says who can or can't be in an affinity group, if it's a company-sponsored one, then you potentially have this issue as to what do we do with people who are putting more and more time into an affinity group and less time into their job.
Blooper. If I drop, just kind of, you know, push me aside and start pressing the buttons on the board, you'll be all right.
Now I know how. I could, yes.
Yes. Well, the show must go on.
Absolutely.
Right?
Ladies and gentlemen. Live from New York, it's Saturday night. So,
how do I type that?
Thank you, Tawny. I appreciate it very much. And I want to thank, again, our listeners for a great year, another great opportunity, and, of course, our sponsors for continuing to provide great educational content to our listeners. We're talking about 2017-2018. What are some of the things that are coming up? Well, you can only imagine. But we're going to tell you. We have 48-hour digital fast coming on July 15th. We're going to be talking about from paper to digital on July 22nd. We're going to be talking about the future workplace experience on July 29th. And on August 5th, we're going to be talking about the gig economy. Great stuff coming up. Don't miss a show. And now your HR tip of the week. Your HR tip of the week is being sponsored by VeralDana.com.
Hi, this is Tawny Alvarez from VeralDana. Are you considering hiring from a competitor? If so, are you instituting best practices to decrease any possible adverse consequences? During the recruiting period, companies should ask the candidate about any possible legal restrictions on employment as soon as possible. If the employee has a non-compete or non-solicitation provision in his or her current position, it could limit the effectiveness of the employee in the future. If the candidate does have legal restrictions, it may not mean that he or she is no longer a contender for the position, but the company will want to assess whether they qualify as a competitor under the terms of the agreement and assess the likelihood of litigation if the hire were to occur. Speaking to counsel is often prudent, but if you do decide to make the hire, make sure that you are clear with the employee as to what your expectations are with regard to solicitation and the use of proprietary information. Contact a member of VeralDana's Labor and Employment Practice Group to discuss the implications of hiring an employee with contractual restrictions.
And that's your HR Tip of the Week, sponsored by VeralDana.com. Next week on the HR Power Hour, Jeff Stern, founder of 48-Hour Digital Fast, will be our guest. Have you ever thought of no phones, no computers, no tablets, no internet, no TV, no screens? Are you scared yet? That's on the next HR Power Hour. Thank you for listening and catch us every week at 10 a.m. on News Talk WLOB 1310 a.m. or streaming live on WLOBradio.com. Podcasts of this show and every show are available at hrpowerhour.com. Have a great week, everyone, and remember, HR management is critical to your business's success.